Your brain needs oxygen.
That sounds like an insult, but it isn't.
Or a Talking Heads lyric.
It totally is. I'm gonna give it to you.
Hello, and welcome to Documenta and Son, being the adventures of a dad who's gay and a son who is figuring shit out. My name is Documenta Barbarism, the sweater girl.
And I'm Dingle Mary, one of Bjork's very own earth intruders.
Oh, we are the earth intruders. Da, 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 da,
da, da. Lyrics.
So good.
Such a good song.
Classic. How you doing, Dingle Mary?
I'm doing very good. I don't know if that accent was...
It's all right. Luckily, I think you remain just on the right side of offensive, so I think we're okay.
It's a thin line, but I am treading it today.
Did you watch We're Here ever in the first season?
Yeah, I watched a bunch of the first season. I stopped after like 3 or 4 episodes before the finale, though.
Yeah, it's not great. I don't love it usually, but they're kind of killing it this season, and this episode especially was so good. They were in, those of you who don't know, We're Here is a show on HBO featuring 3 drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race who go around the country and give usually queers makeovers and prepare them to do a drag show, and they show the cities, it's often small towns throughout America, and they prepare them to do this drag show where sometimes their family comes if they're supported, sometimes they don't, if they're in the closet, whatever. Each one is different. Sometimes it just goes on and on and on. It's Shangela, Bob the Drag Queen, and Eureka O'Hara. This episode, though, was so good. They were in Del Rio, Texas, which is right on the border with Mexico.
Did Bianca guest star?
No, Bianca, that's funny. I didn't even think about that. No, they didn't make one Bianca reference the whole episode.
That is a waste.
Yeah, I'm sure Lady Bunny would disagree with that. But it, just the way that they picked someone who was in the closet mostly, at least to their parents. They picked someone who was out of the closet but going through a gender journey and still having trouble with her parents because of that. And then they picked someone who was the mayor of the town, who was from there.
Wait, what?
Yes. It's this border town. The mayor is this Tejano man, I think probably about my age. He moved away from there for 15 years, but a few years ago got elected mayor.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's incredible. So you see in just this one episode, the 3 sort of different stages of coming out. And I of course, was bawling like half the time. And as the one who was going on more of a gender journey was confronting their parents, I was tense for them and nervous, but also proud of them, but also a little annoyed at them too as a parent because they were being kind of bratty about it, even though they had every right to, and they were in no way at fault. But it was just very cool and moving. And I think partly why the episode appealed to me so well was because it's literally what I'm trying to do with the House of Barbarism, is show these different dimensions. So you've got coming out, you've got you, you've got a gaby, you've got me, a very non-gaby trying to come out, you've got stories of coming out, you've got these different dimensions, and really hopefully people get to drop in at any point and hopefully understand the gay experience a little better. So that's all. I was just really excited by it, and I think you should watch it.
I may watch it.
Oh, you may, if you can fit it in your busy schedule.
I have such a busy schedule. I have to get home, do homework for like 15 minutes, eat dinner, and then play video games for 4 to 5 hours.
How is Metroid?
Okay, it's such a good game. I recently got Metroid Dread for my birthday, which is the new Nintendo release. It's the first... This isn't going to mean anything to non-video game players, but it's the first 2D side-scroller Metroid that's an original game in 20 years.
Whoa, I didn't realize it was that long.
Yeah, It's been so long since an original 2D Metroid came out. All the other 2D Metroids that have come out have all been remakes of previous ones.
Have all your friends been playing it and stuff?
I know a lot of my friends at my new school definitely haven't played it, but they mostly don't play video games anyways.
Right, I'm talking about the video game friends.
But the video game friends, I don't know. I don't know about that. The name of the game is Metroid Dread, and it sure does... I swear I'm going to have a heart attack playing this game. It scares me so much.
A 2D side-scroller is scary?
Yes, but it's not because it's like jump scares or scary monsters. It's because there's these robots that when you enter their zone, if they hear you, they try and see you, and then they chase after you and instant kill you if they catch up to you. And it's so terrifying. It was literally, one point, it was chasing after me, and I was just about to, like, leave the door, and I got through at the last possible second, and then I just sort of collapsed in my chair out of just sheer, like, tension and stress.
I thought I had smelled you shitting yourself.
I shit myself on 3 separate occasions.
Wow. Just start cleaning it up, please. I think Grandma is tired of mopping up after your loose bowels.
Gross.
How was your GSA meeting today?
I had a GSA meeting today. It was great. I met more gays.
There's more gays.
There's so many more.
Were there more people at the meeting this time?
I'm not sure. I think it was roughly the same amount. As you guys remember from last episode, I applied for the role of treasurer.
And?
There has been no decision yet. We haven't shown campaign videos. We're going to do that all next week, next session, which means I actually have time to prepare a video because I didn't for this session. Some of the activities that we did this GSA included the rainbow of post-it notes. So they have all of the pride colors and post-it notes, and we're supposed to write down words that invoke queerness. I wrote the word, well, words, RuPaul's Drag Race, because...
Gentlemen!
Because at least for me, that started my queer journey. Someone wrote the word lemon, and then that was replaced with a picture of a strawberry and, like, a lime and grapes or whatever, because we're fruity.
Okay. It's true, true, yes.
My friend just wrote gay with 15 A's. That's all the ones that I can think of at the moment. Oh, someone did draw a little flame, and then someone else did flamboyant. That's all I remember.
Did these get put up around, or what's the goal?
I don't know if they're going to post it in a hallway or something, but they put them all on a black piece of paper in the rainbow configuration. So I assume it's going to be hung up somewhere. We also played a little bit of queer trivia, just quick questions about queerness.
Like what?
There were 2 true or false ones, and one of them was police arrested people for cross-dressing on Halloween, like, in the 1900s. And the answer was false, because apparently so many people cross-dressed during Halloween that they just threw up their hands and gave up.
Where?
I don't know. That's just what the question they gave was. An answer.
Okay. Maybe we need a little bit more specificity there. Yeah.
And then they had like a table of 9 people, and the question was, which of these are queer icons? And it was all of them.
Do you remember any of them?
Some of them included Oscar Wilde. That was one I remembered.
When I came to pick you up, you were chatting with... I recognized one of your friends, I think, but those... Other 2 were also in the GSA?
Yes, they were all in the GSA. I did notice you parking there. I looked over and was like, I'm going to ignore him and talk with my friends for 15 minutes, because we were all standing there anyways. And I think I made the right decision.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I figured it's great that you get to chances to speak to people, to your peers, your age, from your school. In person, in the flesh. So yeah, I'm all for it.
Yeah. And not only are they my peers, they're my queer peers. Or as I like to call them, queers. It's the beginning of queers and the end of peers.
Yeah, we got it.
Okay.
You're so clever.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, we were lucky enough to spend time with Dingle Mummy.
I love Dingle Mommy. I'm so sad she's gone.
We drove up to New England. We went to the Bread and Puppet Theater Museum.
All the puppets there were so creepy.
You definitely seem to be less into that place than Dingle Mommy and I did. Did you enjoy it at all?
Yeah, I thought the puppets were cool. There's a lot of really, like, big ones. There was one at least three times my height just sitting on the ceiling being all, hello. It was organized so that on the first floor, there were three aisles of some of the smaller or even human-sized puppets that they had. And then you go upstairs, and they just have a bunch of really big ones, including sets from shows, like masses, little puppets that indicate masses that would shake around, I guess. And then just big ones, like big people, big faces, big monsters. It was really cool.
It was really incredible to feel that heavy weight of 5+ decades of performance history of this company who moved up to Vermont from the city and just has been putting on these Marxist, what are you doing?
Trying to yawn but not make a sound.
That was the weirdest face you've ever made.
I'm sorry. I was trying not to let the yawn sound on pod.
Wow.
That has to go in.
Sure.
Yay.
I lost my train of thought, but Bread and Puppet Theater, it's very cool. Go check it out. Unfortunately, it is closing November 1st. It's only open from June 1st to November 1st each year, I believe. So if you're not able to get up to northern, very rural Vermont, maybe try again next year after June.
It's squished between two separate horse ranches.
It is. And be sure to check out the outhouse if you go out there. It's a very jaunty outhouse.
On the outhouse, there's a sign that just says, outhouse, with an exclamation mark. And then there's like 5 little paintings of different ways people go to the bathroom.
It was very interesting.
It was.
We also just drove through New Hampshire and spent the majority of the time in Maine on around Portland, went to the Calendar Islands, the Giant Stairs. It was very fun.
It's a full of seafood restaurants, and I really enjoyed the steak I got.
Typical Dingle. Did you eat any seafood?
No.
I don't think you did.
I did not eat a single piece of seafood.
That's all right. Dingle Mommy and I ate more than enough for the three of us.
Yes.
Lobster, lobster mac and cheese, lobster roll, crab roll, shrimp roll, haddock chowder, clam chowder, all the chowders.
3 hours later.
This is the second time we've been able to hang out with Dingle Mommy like this since the divorce earlier in the year. Did the second time feel any different from the first? Is it getting any easier? What's it like for you having both Dingle Mommy and I? Me.
English is hard.
And me around.
I think it was easier just because I've made my peace more with the divorce and what our family unit looks like. But it was also harder because I'm now so much taller than Dingle Mommy. As she mentioned that when she saw me standing next to you at the airport, she didn't even recognize it was me because I was so tall.
So what about that made it harder?
I don't know. I just felt uncomfortable maybe being so tall around her.
You sure rub it in her face a lot.
Yeah, but that's just because I'm a shady bitch.
That's interesting. I wonder what that's about. Is it that you know, you realize now that you're definitely not a kid compared with the fact of turning 16?
Yeah, it's a whole cacophony of growths. Ooh, that's a really disturbing thought.
Next time on A Cacophony of Growths.
Oh, no.
This was more fun for me, obviously, than the first one because I was recovering from surgery at the last one and couldn't really do much. So it's nice to be able to move around more. And I think gets a little easier every time for me too. It's nice to be reminded that we are still a family, even if it doesn't look exactly like it did before, even if our tax status has changed, even if the government doesn't say we're a family anymore. It's nice to still go on road trips and feel like we are, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Did anything about the weekend or the trip make you sad?
No. I think I've come in to peace. No, that's not the term. I've come to peace.
Come to terms?
Come to terms, yeah. Come to terms with our family unit and our status.
It doesn't make you sad anymore?
I mean, it does, but it doesn't make me more sad now. Like, the sadness is lessening, and now it's just sort of like, there, you know.
It is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's good. I love that. Just remember that it's okay if it doesn't. Sometimes grief and sadness doesn't progress in a straight line. So when it does get hard, know that that's okay. And there's nothing wrong with you feeling sad about a thing that you feel like you should have already worked through. You may feel sad about it at certain points for the rest of your life. Who knows? I don't know. My parents aren't divorced, so.
Oh, my God.
No, that's not what I meant.
Oh, no.
I meant, since my parents are divorced, I don't know.
Oh, my God. Oh, he's doing it again.
My parents are happily married.
No, stop.
So I meant, I don't know how to, from personal experience, guide you through this, but yeah. Always I hope you feel free and okay to talk to Mom and I about these things.
Of course.
Good. Let's take a break. If you live in the greater New York area or have a good microphone and would like to share your story on Closet Practice, anonymously or not, message me on Twitter at DocumentaB, on Instagram at DocumentaBarbarism, online at documentabarbarism.com or by email to buttstuff@documentabarbarism.com with only one A in barbarism. That's DocumentaBarbarism. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe to House of Barbarism on your pod thingy of choice so you don't miss a single episode of Adventures in Gabysitting and Closet Practice every Monday, and Documenta and Son every Thursday. Welcome back, campers.
I'm trying to remember the Gigi Good line now.
Good morning, campers.
Good morning, Miss Good.
I hope you save room for thirds.
Thirds.
Gigi Good. All right, for this episode, we read Charles M. Blow's memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, and had the great pleasure of viewing the opera adaptation of the book at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City.
Oh, very fancy.
Super fancy. We are fancy as shit.
And we have the money to back it.
That's funny. Tell another one. So this was your first time ever seeing an opera, Nispa, and your first time in a theater since the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah, it's the first time in the theater.
When was the last time we went before?
Jagged Little Pill.
Duh, of course.
Literally days before the lockdown began.
I think 2 days before Broadway shut down.
And we took taxis, we ate at restaurants.
We sat there in that theater and breathed in the COVID from whoever knows how many people.
It's amazing. None of us caught it.
Or maybe we did and it was just
Yeah, it could be asymptomatic.
So what was your first experience like in seeing an opera?
Well, the whole time I felt underdressed. At least while walking in and getting our tickets checked and all that. But then when we went up and sat in the nosebleeds with all of the other pores, I felt better suited.
That's true. We were not out of place up in the family circle, I believe they call the poor person's area, which is hilarious.
There is a pricing guide for tickets near the ticket booth, and it was family circle, 30, and then it was orchestra seats. 700.
Was that the premium seating?
Yes. And I was like, ugh.
That's incredible.
It wounds me.
What did you think of the Met, the opera house?
It looked different from what I expected it. I expected it to look like big theaters in classic movies. Like the theater in the Marx Brothers film, Night at the Opera.
More ornate, maybe?
Yeah, more ornate, a lot more paintings that look like they belong in an Italian chapel or church.
That makes sense. It is kind of the same for me, too. It makes sense because it wasn't built until mid-20th century. I think Lincoln Center was over the 50s, 60s. Like, oh, yeah, of course, because West Side Story, have I ever told you this, was filmed. And the reason they were able to film there was because that neighborhood had already been cleared out and was zoned for to be razed and completely destroyed to build Lincoln Center.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so then they built Lincoln Center in the 60s. And that makes sense that it was a little more modernist than some of the more classical opera houses, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of curves and solid color structures.
I like a lot of curves.
I don't know if you're allowed to like curves.
It is interesting that for a building that is modern and modernist in a way, they have still been so bound to opera tradition in the sense that Fire Shut Up in My Bones is the first opera by a black composer ever in the Met's history. Now, the company itself extends back way further. It's like 138-year history or something. The company around has been around a lot longer than the building, but ever in 140 years, which is shocking, but then also maybe not so shocking in that their 2015 Othello was the first one ever to not use blackface. So it makes sense because opera is an aristocratic tradition. It is very conservative. It's often very reactionary. It's a tool of the upper classes. So it's in some cases no surprise because if any art form is going to be tethered, anchored to whiteness, to privilege, to power, it's going to be opera.
Yeah.
And that's partly why opera has become so calcified in some ways and so uninteresting and so uninterested in speaking to other classes or other peoples outside of its core group, its core centers of power. Which is part of why this opera is so exciting, because it introduces so many things. Probably doesn't introduce them into the form. I don't know if there was anything new in this opera that hasn't been done in other operas. They did have step dancing in Act 3, which was fucking cool.
What a great part.
Perhaps that was the first time there has been step dancing in an opera. That wouldn't surprise me. I did see an opera in when I was in London called The Gospel According to the Other Mary by John Adams that had this one dancer named Banks, who was a flex and crump dancer. It was so fucking cool. He definitely stood out from the rest of the opera. It was clear that he was put there as a disruptive force, a disruptive image to what's going on in the rest of the opera. And I felt like the step dancing in Act 3 of Fire Shut Up in My Bones also functioned in maybe the same way.
Yeah, it sort of served as a departure and segue into the home life of Act 2 and 1 into college life of Act 3.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It was a very clear break
exactly.
From what had come before.
Also, it was flex and crump dancing, like, pop and lock, but with, like, it's like with crazy arm contortions, right?
Kind of. That's the flex, if I understand it correctly. Flex is more of that type of thing where they do that crazy shit that make their arms and bodies bend in ways that arms and bodies are not meant to bend. Crumping, you don't see quite as much anymore. It's, from what I could tell, at least in culture, pop culture, it was more of a 2000s phenomenon. There was a documentary on it called Rise. But it's also very jittery, very active, very tremulous.
Mm.
And I really like when they bring these ultra-modern forms, these very black forms, into a very white form of opera. Also because the step dancing wasn't opera-fied in any way. It was a step routine being done in front of us. Whereas the music by composer Terence Blanchard, who is most known for his scores for Spike Lee films. He scored a shit ton of Spike Lee movies.
I forgot that.
Uh-huh. And once you know that, if you have ever watched a Spike Lee movie and then you listen to this score, you're like, oh yeah, duh, totally.
Oh yeah, duh, totally.
See, you literally are playing it out. It's literally playing out in front of my very eyes. And his score was so interesting in the way it incorporated jazz. He's also a jazz trumpeter, so it was very jazzy. Oh my god, you've got to stop making those funny yawn faces. I cannot.
I'm trying to do it without making a sound.
Or you could just, like, not do it.
I'm sorry, I'm tired.
Yeah, I'm sorry too.
My coffee wore off like 4 hours ago.
That is tough.
I have a Dr. Pepper here, but it's not the same.
And there was a drum set and things like that. But those, the jazz, the drums, the instruments like that were folded more into this operatic style. Whereas that, the step dancing in Act 3, was just a step dance. And you could feel the audience respond to it in a way they hadn't really to any of the other parts. Before we go any further talking about it, just a brief plot summary. It's a memoir. Charles M. Blow, he's a writer, he's an opinion writer for the New York Times, but don't hold that against him. He grew up in Gibbsland, Louisiana, it's called. Literally, it was Gibbsland. It was an old slave plantation that had become a town over time. Grew up dirt poor, literally, eating dirt sometimes. He grew up dirt poor with brothers, with his mother, his father, who eventually left the family. The story is primarily about his response to the trauma that grew out of being sexually abused by a cousin. How old was he when that happened?
He was 12, I believe, in the memoir.
Okay, so around that age. So it's a lot of things. It's a story about trauma. It's a story about poverty. It's a story about family. It's about the South. It pretty much ends with his college years. At the end of the memoir, he points briefly to his career and the things he's done since then. But it's really a memoir of childhood. Mm-hmm. It's a memoir of growing up and overcoming trauma. What were your impressions of, first, the book? What did you think of the memoir?
The memoir entranced me. No, that's not the word. Is it?
Yeah, it's a bit cliche, but sure.
It entranced me more than I thought it would. Mm. I don't generally read memoirs, but I really enjoyed it, despite the horrible shit that happens. Mm. I wouldn't say that I see myself in Charles, because I don't. I haven't had the same experiences as him, but it is interesting to see a different way in which a queer kid grew up.
You don't see any of yourself in him or his experiences?
Not really.
That's interesting. I want to come back to that, because I think there might be more, you might have more in common than you might think. Mm. What about the opera?
As anyone who's been to the opera will know, you definitely need the captions when listening to it. I couldn't understand. I understand, like, words every now and then, but if I wanted to have a chance of understanding the music, I had to stare at the captions.
It is amazing how the opera form is so much about the quality of the voice and less about what the voice is actually saying.
Yeah.
Or less about what the actors are doing on stage, and really about what's coming out of their throats.
Exactly.
I don't think that they were amplified at all. I don't know if they... Could you tell? I don't think
Wait,
they were
really? Mic'd.
I don't think so. It didn't have... Again, it's hard to tell because we're so far back. I don't think that opera mics or amplifies the same way we're used to on Broadway. Because they sing with such power. Stop it.
I am making a confused face at the moment.
I could be wrong. Don't quote me on that. But it didn't. The quality of the sound did not sound amplified. And is also, I think, part of why we couldn't understand it very well. Because there was these voices competing with this orchestra in front of them. Maybe it was. I don't know.
Hmm.
I couldn't tell. It didn't, to my untrained ear, it didn't sound. I didn't hear sound coming from around the way that you do when they are mic'd. There might have been a little to help them out. But that's also what makes this material so interesting as a choice for an opera, because it's not about power. It's about the lack of power.
Yeah.
Whereas operatic singing is powerful and does have to reach way up into the back, into the rafters. I also loved the memoir. I think Charles Blow is an incredible stylist. He just chooses the right word all the time. He doesn't over-describe, but he also really relishes a beautiful turn of phrase. He finds just the right word. At one point, he talks about how, I can't even remember the exact phrase, but the way he describes the way that age had wrapped an old man around his uncle's bones or something like that was so perfect and so evocative and so poetic. The libretto for the opera, which is by Casey Lemons, who I know more as a film director. This was her first opera libretto. It did a great job of finding a narrative core, I felt, to carry through the opera, of condensing a memoir into a 3-hour opera length. I don't think that the libretto needs to carry the poetry from the original memoir. That's the job of the music, really, I think. And in that sense, I think it did work very well. the words, for the most part, got out of the music's way. I also liked that it wasn't afraid to go to some dark places, not just in terms of the abuse, but, and not even dark places necessarily, but to make some juicy metaphors, like when his mother's working at the chicken factory and they compare the butchered chickens to a tight pussy. I was like, yes, this is opera. Thank you, opera. So overall, I enjoyed it. The first act especially was hard to get into for me. It's always difficult when you read the source material for an adaptation. It's hard to not compare the two, even though you really shouldn't. There's almost no benefit that comes out of that, because the new thing is a new thing. It's its own animal. It's not, it may take very little from the original source material. And also just musically, nothing really stood up and grabbed me until the opening of the second act when they went to church. When that choir came out, do you remember when the choir, this massive choir comes walking out from the back? And of course, there's no music like gospel music.
Yep.
It just gets right to that place in your brain where you can't help but believe for a second. I believe in God when I listen to gospel music. Then once it's over, I come back to my senses.
It's interesting how he starts each act, not necessarily the first act, but he splits into the second and third acts by putting in this sort of, not famous, but strong black musical forms that are almost an antithesis to opera, almost.
Yeah, that's very true. They work beautifully, but they are, in a way, a negation, perhaps, of certainly the whiteness inherent in the operatic form. Absolutely. And they work so well for the story, because church, college, those represented two major milestones in Charles's life. As he strove, is that a word?
Yeah.
Strived? Striven?
It's strove.
As he strivenated? As he tried to come to terms and to deal with this trauma where his life had split open. Church, first in God, first in church, and then in school and in women and things like that. So that part, I think, worked beautifully. And in an interview, Terrence Blanchard talks about how some of the singers were having a hard time because they were classically trained, operatically trained, and then they were given this gospel music to do, and they weren't sure what to do with that. Do I do this as opera? Do I do this as gospel? And he basically said, yes. He encouraged them to bring their own past, their own experiences singing gospel into the opera, which was wonderful. Not that I give a shit that the operatic form survive or be revivified. Like, who gives a shit? Let it die. I couldn't care less. But I think it's exciting to see when two seemingly contradictory forms like that clash. Is this a gay story?
In my opinion, it's not a gay story. It's a queer story. Charles isn't gay. He's bisexual. And this is about him coming into his bisexuality, not necessarily not just his gayness. At one point in both the memoir and the opera, he has this dream of these not necessarily erotic male figures, but they're sort of like moving around him, and that's a really great moment in the musical as well, or the opera.
Yes, I loved that. You didn't think it was erotic? I thought it was erotic.
I mean,
it was very erotic.
In the opera, it's erotic, but I don't believe he describes them as being erotic or sexy in any way in the memoir.
They're almost more nightmarish, aren't they?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, no, he did. He speaks about this in the book. He says, it's not that I didn't also think about girls and women at night. I did compulsively. It's just that the male images sometimes came in their stead, but not in the same way. They were a presence, a wistfulness, yearning spirits lingering near the place where a life was once lost. So he's talking about the interior emotional and spiritual death, I think, that came with being abused. They were faceless and without form, no one I knew, and not naked like the women, but definitely male. But then he also says they were not aggressive, but rather an amalgamation of the boy. Oops. an amalgamation of all the men who had ever been nice to me, soothing antidotes to the boy who had tried to take advantage of me. So yeah, they were, the facelessness seems to be, would imply fright, would imply scariness, but then at the same time, they were also loving and warm. There was a warmth to them. How did you feel about how the opera handled the gay side of him, of his bisexuality, versus the book?
I think the book gives more time to the exploration of him growing into his homoerotic passions than the opera did. I think that may partially just be because the opera had to cut out so much. There was a lot of the memoir that didn't appear in the opera, but I don't think it gives it enough time in the opera, because it is an important part, not only of the memoir, but of Charles Blow's life. The one song we got was really cool, and
that was kind of it.
Yeah. He confesses to a woman lover of his towards the end of the opera, and that's it.
Yeah, that was definitely an issue I had. Not that the opera has to do what the memoir does, but it felt very uncomfortable with gayness, with queerness overall, which could be that the creators are not gay themselves.
Yeah.
I guess it's not particularly useful to speculate on why or why not a thing is, but this, I think, also goes back to a structural issue that I do have with the memoir that the opera did also carry over as well. It opens on this incredible, intense scene where he's driving, he's tearing down the road with a gun, ready to go kill the man who had raped him years before. J.J. Abrams style, it's starting at the climax, and then you wait the whole time for it to get back to that. And then finally at the end, it gets to that moment, and the moment just dissipates. It just falls away. Even in the book, it just is a couple paragraphs where he basically says, I decided I shouldn't do that. It's not that. It's better than that. It's more interesting than that. But literally, that's about it. He just says, then I just realized that I shouldn't. And that's what happens in the opera, pretty much, too. It's a bit of an anticlimax, which is fine. But it's this feeling of confusion. I was never really sure which story the opera was telling from one moment to the next. There was the stuff with his mother. There was the stuff with his home, with his siblings. He had a relationship. He went to college. It felt more like a discrete series of events than an actual story being told. And then at the end, he was fine, I guess. But it got to the end, and it didn't feel like it had earned that ending. And of course, opera is about so much more than just the story, but it is telling a story. Terrence Blanchard also talks in an interview about how when we think of universal stories, they tend to be white stories. How people always just assume that if a story is primarily about black characters, then it's a story about blackness. Whereas with this, he wanted to create something universal, because why can't a story about black people be universal in the sense that they're dealing with love, they're dealing with trauma, they're dealing with the pain of being alive? And I think he's absolutely right. There's nothing universal about whiteness. It's just that whiteness is what tends to get privileged the most. And that's why I think that you may have a lot more in common with the story than you realize. One thing particularly is the way, first, that Charles, when he's young, they call him Charles Baby, the way he hangs on his mother and just desires her presence and her warmth and her attention so deeply. I feel like you still do that a lot with me and Dingle Mommy, which is great, which we love.
I do it with you, but mainly it's with my stuffed monkey. At least at a young age, it was with my stuffed monkey. No, it is still. I seek attention from my stuffed monkey.
In the memoir on page 28, he says, it wasn't a physical loneliness as much as an emotional, spiritual loneliness, a need to be seen and hugged and kissed and held. It was a need to be told stories and have someone listen patiently as I asked too many questions. It was a need to laugh until I cried about nothing, silly things, with someone who made me feel that I was everything.
I forgot that part.
Does that not feel like
no,
you?
No, that is absolutely me.
And that's okay. That's a good thing, because we all desire that. We all need that. He, in the opera, he kept saying, I hurt from wanting intimacy. And that's ultimately what I think the opera, even more so than the memoir maybe, was about this desire for intimacy. That's what he wanted. For him, it ultimately becomes less about gender or genitals than it is about that intimate connection that he has with another human being.
Yeah.
I also think that the sort of I also think that the confused relationship the source material and the opera have with gayness is also a reflection, perhaps, of Charles M. Blow himself. It seems that, at least at the time he wrote this in 2014 or whatever, he was still coming to terms with it. I know he wasn't really publicly out until the book came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, you know, go later in life, coming out stories. Woohoo. We should come up with a term for us. What would be a good term for those of us who come out late in life?
Gay adults.
Gay adults. That's pretty good. Yeah, because it's good, like the opposite of gaybies. Mm-hmm. Gay adults. But that also makes it sound like dolts who are gay. Gayniers? No, because I'm not a senior.
I was trying to do a senior pun as well.
Gay. Old. Gold. Gale. Golden. Golden gays? No, I think that is the term, actually. Okay, well, I'm going to think more on this off mic. We're going to come up with, you need to help me. Listeners, also, please feel free to submit your ideas. And so I get it. I understand that when you do come out that late in life, I mean, I'm saying that late. We're not that old. He wasn't that old when he came out, you know, mid to late 40s, I think.
Well, he wasn't that old.
He was that old. There's an unresolvedness to it. And that's okay. That's fine. I don't think that there has to be a firm conviction one way or another, because we're all works in progress. Is there anything else you want to say about fire? Shut up in my bones.
I do not have anything else to say on the pot about fire. Shut up in my bones.
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 Fire. Shut up in my bones. Ooh, I made it erotic. All right, let's catch a break before
fire. Shut up in my bones.
I'm pretty sure I made that joke to you, and then you said that wasn't funny.
Who, me? I would never appropriate someone else's joke that I had already disdained.
Mm.
I do want to touch on loneliness just a bit. There's a line, it's loneliness who stays. Loneliness is a character in the opera. We probably haven't mentioned that Destiny is also a character in the opera. His destiny is, at the very beginning and throughout, egging him on, leading him down a dark path, perhaps.
When he's preparing to go shoot Chester, Destiny is like, what did I tell you? There's no escape. This was always going to happen.
And then loneliness is a character as well. And it's interesting because I'm not sure that the work ever fully disagrees with that statement, that it's the loneliness who stays. It almost treats loneliness as an essential facet of the queer experience. Did you get that feeling too?
I did. And it's an interesting duality to how much they also talk about how Charles needed his mother, you know, and how he needed that emotional attachment. But even then, even when he spent all that time with his mother, loneliness is still there.
It's like what Jose Munoz says about queerness. It's never there. It's always on the horizon. It's something we're always reaching for, but can never actually touch.
Who is he?
He's a queer theorist.
Oh.
I don't understand most of what he says, but that bit I think I get. But then it draws an interesting connection between loneliness and strength. So when he's pledging the fraternity, they get severely beaten, and he's the one that's able to accept to deal with those beatings the best out of anyone, which they really rush through and don't really. If you haven't read the book, I think that part might be confusing.
Yeah, the whole frat part is very strange, especially considering. Yeah, how much they cut out of the book. It mostly just serves as a setup into his relationship with this woman, Greta. And that's it. Whereas in the book, it is a more important part of his life. He talks about it a lot more, about how he formed these bonds with his fellow frat boys who were also hazed at the same time as him.
Right. And again, in the opera, it was just another thing that happened.
Yeah.
Right. And the work does clearly draw a connection between the suffering that black people as a whole in this country have dealt with. There was a line that said, we draw our strength from slavery, and suffering in this formation turns into a crucible, which is always an interesting way for me to think about marginalization and suffering, because so if suffering is what makes us strong, if there is no suffering, can there be strength?
It's interesting.
I don't know. So what I'm trying to work through, and I don't really have an answer or a solution, is what is this connection between queerness, between blackness for Charles M. Blow, which from what I've read of him and from what I've read in the book, I think he values more even than queerness. He talks about, he had a piece in the Times about during Pride Month about how he's always felt much more comfortable with other black people than with other queers. Mm-hmm. Because queers are just as fucking racist as any other people. And when he came out, he had to deal with a lot of that shit from white gays, for the most part.
Yeah.
In a way that white people who come out later in life don't have to deal with. So I guess what I'm trying to say, and what I found so beautiful and moving about the work as a whole, is the way that it... I don't think it's saying that you need to suffer to be strong. I don't think it's saying that suffering is an essential component of life. But it really is a testament to the way that suffering, if it doesn't break you, if you just bend, and if you allow it to not break you, can help you find a path forward and even make you stronger than others, than people who don't have to experience those same kind of things. I don't think it's a romanticization of suffering. I don't know. Did you feel like it glorified or romanticized suffering?
No, absolutely not. He was like, had to grovel at the feet of these hazers who were like whipping him. Like, that's not romanticizing it at all, you know?
That's true. I don't think they're necessarily finding beauty in pain or beauty in suffering, but more in the ability to overcome those things and forge ahead and create yourself and create your life despite all of the shitty things that you have to go through. So I think I agree that it's not really a gay story necessarily, and not even just because he's bi. I think that it really is a universal story in that sense. Not that blackness isn't a key component to it. Blackness is central to his experiences and to the pride he seems to take in being a human being and being black. But even with that said, it really is universal. It's about loss and about strength and overcoming. While at the same time, it also makes me proud to be queer. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I'm proud to be queer, too.
What role do you think suffering is going to play in your formation of queer identity? Do you feel fear when you think about the future?
No. I'm fairly confident in how I want my life to go. And I've planned that out as best as I can while also maintaining a sort of loose idea of what actually is going to happen, like the specificity. Dang, I just stumbled over that word. The specificities.
Do you feel that without going through similar suffering to like what Charles went through, you'll have the strength to deal with whatever life throws at you?
I mean, I have gone through suffering, you know. It's been different suffering than him. For me, it was the pandemic and having to grow up and do school and not be able to see any of my friends. Only now, a year later, am I actually like going to school again and really seeing my friends often in person. And that's been super great, but the last year was like really hard on me in so many ways.
Absolutely. It's been hard on everyone. And I don't want to push too hard in this direction, but so are you saying then that your suffering is the same as what Charles went through?
No, it's different. For him, it was a lack of friends. And for me, it was, I have friends, but I'm not able to be with them. You know, it's sort of like a tearing away of a chunk of my soul, almost.
Well, no, for him, it was rape.
Well, yes. But also, like, as we said, loneliness and how attached he felt to his mother.
That's true. No, that's a good point. And I'm being a bit of a devil's advocate here because these are issues that I'm also trying to work through. I've, in a way, been anxious about dealing with this work on the pod just because blackness is so central to it. And it's like, what the fuck can we say about that? And really, about blackness, we can say nothing, you know, because it's not, we don't have that right. We don't have that privilege. We don't need to. No one gives a shit even anyway what we would have to say about that. And yet I want to honor it. I want to honor those aspects of it. And I want to also draw benefit from it for both you and for me, but also just really enjoy it as a piece of art, as a beautiful memoir and as a mostly beautiful opera. So that's it. There's not really any conclusion to draw from that, I don't think. I think it's just, we can really point to these issues and say, look, issues.
It's like the opera. This has just been a series of very vaguely connected concepts.
Yes, it is like the opera. Yes, I think you could say our podcast is operatic.
Oh, not that kind, though.
No. Anyway, I think with that, we will call it an evening. What do you say?
I agree.
I know normally at this time, at this point, we would have a mag, ask me anything gay. That's all right. There will always be more gay questions to ask. I think we have given our readers just such high quality, deep, profound things to chew on. Anything more would just be decadent. Do you have anything else you want to say to our lovely listeners at home?
Keep on listening. And listen to all the other pods.
Yes, do. Please. Yes, we thank you, those of you who are listening. Please, 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 if you would, if you're enjoying what you're listening, even if you're not enjoying what you're listening but would like to support us, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple. I don't care if I sound like I'm begging. I am. I'm pathetic. I know. I just want those 5 stars. And if you could take a few minutes out of your day while you're sitting on the toilet, waiting in line, scrolling through before bed, write us a nice little review on Apple. That would also be a huge help. Apparently that stuff feeds the algorithm. I don't quite know how, but it would be a fabulous help to us. Tell all your friends to listen. Tell your mothers. Tell your fathers. Tell your butchers. Tell your bakers. Tell your candlestick makers.
He was staring at me while he was saying that, and I'm pretty sure he's still resentful that I haven't told all my friends about the pod.
Oh, that's hilarious. That was subconscious, if that. But yes, tell all your friends. But no, we thank you. We really do are so grateful that you choose to spend some time with us. We hope that it's worthwhile, and we love talking. Well, I can't speak for you. I enjoy this time with you. You have been yawning all night, so I can't really speak for you.
I'm sorry. Thank you to all of our listeners, but specifically for me, at least, Dingle Auntie. We still appreciate you.
Okay, Dingle Auntie has gotten enough attention. But yes, she has listened to every episode, so she does deserve a shout out.
We salute.
Thanks, everyone. Tune in on Monday, next Monday, for a brand new episode of Closet Practice. It's a good one. I'm excited for everyone to hear it. So with that, we will say thank you and good night.
Adieu, adieu. I'm just trying to be fancy like the opera peoples.
Fancy like the opera peoples.
The Dingle Mary story.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
This has been another House of Barbarism podcast. Written, recorded, edited, and produced by Document of Barbarism. Your friendly neighborhood mountain man fairy princess. Remember, there is no document of civilization which is not, at the same time, a documenta barbarism. Mwah.